Thanks for the great introduction. Actually, there's one other point on the resume. Right before grad school, I did 2 years as a high school teacher in New York City, probably just long enough to know how incompetent I was. So I can't claim to have mastered the field, but it was tremendous training actually for graduate school, because a lot of what we do is just talk to people and talk to each other, and you know, you learn to throw together a lecture very fast, right? Especially as a new teacher, when you have 3 preps of, you know, things you've never taught before every day. So that's good. It also gave me a very strange set of nightmares, because as I started giving scientific lectures, you know, those were stressful, and you may believe that teaching is somewhat stressful, especially when you're starting out, and those things combined. And so I'd have these nightmares where I would be giving a scientific lecture and with very distinguished people in the audience who would then start getting up and just losing concentration and throwing paper airplanes and very strange, you know. Seeing Millie Dresselhaus disbehave in my lecture was, that's it. Condensed matter joke. But anyway, it's great to be here, and hopefully I can share some insight and some stuff, hopefully that you can, you know, get into your class somehow. So I'm going to talk about measuring mechanical properties of graphene, and also I'll slip in a little bit of stuff with carbon nanotubes, and it'll all be done using relatively simple physics and, you know, some somewhat expensive equipment, which I know everybody here doesn't have, but the principles I hope are pretty straightforward. So what am I talking about when I talk about mechanics? Really, there are lots of things, but the two really fundamental things we measure, if you just think about stretching a slab of material, one thing is called the Young's modulus. This is like a spring constant, right? So this is Hooke's law, but for a 3D material. So if you think about a spring, this would be F is equal to Kx, or K delta X, right? So this is now, instead of force, it's force per unit area here. This is the kind of a spring constant of the material. It doesn't depend on the size. It's the intrinsic stiffness of the material. And this is the strain. This is just the relative change in the length of the material, right? So you put in the geometry, that gives you a spring constant, that gives you F equals Kx, but it's the same thing. All right, so Young's modulus is the measure of the spring the stiffness of the material you're going to use for whatever you're going to use in what I call the elastic regime. That's where you stretch and you let it go and it goes back and is the same material, right? So if you think of bending a piece of metal, if you bend it a little bit, it bends right back. If you bend it too much, it stays bent, right? So that is now entering what's called the plastic regime, where things have rearranged inside the material. It's no longer exactly the way it started. So this doesn't hold once you start to get plastic deformation. So the other thing, but we're just going to talk about this for the most part. The other thing that's important is the maximum stress the material can withstand before it breaks. Right? So that's the strength. So often, even in scientific circles, those two things are somewhat, they're interchanged where they shouldn't be. They talk about a high strength material, the Young's modulus is so and so. That's not strength, that's stiffness. Right? Strength is how much can I pull it until it breaks. I just stole this from somewhere on the web. Everything our students shouldn't do, we do all the time. Stiffness again is talks about how much does something deform when I apply a load to it, and strength is when does it break. All right, so there we go. So strength especially is a funny, you know. Stiffness, in some ways, you can think of atomic bonds. Those atomic bonds act like little springs. And more or less, the stiffness of a material, it depends on the stiffness of all those little atomic bonds and all the springs. And you can kind of understand that it's kind of what you would expect, right? Strength, on the other hand, is really very different, right? So if you try to understand, so at the beginning of the last century, beginning of the 20th century, lots of people were trying to think about this, because they started to understand what all the energies of the bonds holding together materials were, and they said, all right, well, you know, I know how much energy is in each all of these bonds, so if I imagine just pulling the material apart, I've had to break a certain number of bonds, and so therefore I've had to input a certain amount of energy over a certain amount of distance. That's going to take a certain amount of force. That should be the force required to break. And so that gives you, you know, basically that's this kind of surface energy and atomic separation. This is what was predicted to be the intrinsic strength of materials. And the problem is, as people started to make and test and break materials, they found that this theoretical strength is usually in the range of gigapascals. So pascal is a newton per meter, right? So 10 to the ninth newtons per meter, right? They, you know, there are all these different values. But then if you actually measure these things, they're in the megapascal range, right? The three orders of magnitude down, or at least two, right? So you can actually take the ratio, and depending on the material, you know, some of them are certainly pretty close, but in general, normal materials like steel, right, the theoretical strength is 180 times larger than the measured strength, right? So are the materials we work with every day, you know, we don't usually use silica fibers or iron whiskers or anything like that. Things like metals, glass, anything like that, are nowhere near as strong as the basic kind of back of the envelope calculation says it should be. Right? So something's a little funny here. There's another way to think about how strong a material is. This was predicted by Griffith, who is British, I forget. He was not at a big university. I forget where he was. But in 1927, he did a bunch of tests of fracture strength of glass fibers. So you take a piece of glass and you put it under a torch, and you can pull it thinner and thinner, and you can start testing how strong is it as a function of radius. And what he noticed was that the smaller they were, the stronger they were. Kind of weird, right? So the strength really went up. So this is diameter in microns and in micrometers, right? So, you know, 20 times 10 to the minus 6 meters, you go up, and you start to get improvements of a couple orders of magnitude in strength. And so, you know, what he did is just naturally keep extrapolating. So he went down, not for 10 microns, but down to more like, you know, 1 nanometer. He just said, well, let me just for fun, let me imagine I've thinned my glass fiber down so it's just one chain of atoms. And if he did that, he predicted that the maximum intrinsic strength should be about the Young's modulus divided by 7. That's more or less saying that if what you're going to do is if you have an atomic bond and you stretch it by about 14%, it breaks. You know, it is a little bit more complicated than that, but not much, right? So, and I'll get to the slight twist, but just that's basically what's going on there, right? And but of course that's never been seen. And the basic idea here is that in normal everyday life, in the materials we use, the strength is not determined by the strength to rupture all of the bonds in the cross section of the material. It's completely determined by cracks, dislocations, any kind of imperfections in the material, right? So a simple example is if you have a piece of duct tape and you want to break it, right? You always have to, you know, tear it with your teeth or tear it or cut it a little bit. And once you put a little notch into a piece of tape, right, it tears really easily, right? So if you have so breakage of materials is not determined by breaking the whole thing, but it's propagation of cracks through the materials. And in fact, so, you know, the fields of metallurgy and material science have, you know, giant piles of literature, and very, very, this is really, it uses all the same math as general relativity. It's really nasty stuff, very, very complicated, but they really figured out how all of these cracks behave. I mean, there's still ongoing work in the field, but for the most part, in things like normal metals, they understand how these cracks behave. to the point where actually anytime you fly in an airplane, it's full of cracks. And what they do is they just keep track of them. And they know that this one's getting bigger. Okay. We got a few more years on this plane. Don't worry about it. Right? And some of the early spectacular failures of commercial jet airliners, which are attributable to not understanding how these cracks move and how these cracks start. And then basically a couple planes just fell. That was that. But that's why you have, by the way, round windows in airplanes. So it's all about cracks and imperfections in materials that cause them to have a much lower strength when we measure them in the bulk world in our size scale than they should have on the atomic scale. Okay, so obviously we're interested in graphene. I'll just talk a little bit about carbon nanotubes also. We're interested in seeing, these are materials which are pretty darn close to perfect. We're really interested in what does mechanics look like for those materials. Right, so before we get there, just because we're all a little tired from lunch, getting that what we call the Mexican sleeping pill in graduate school. exactly. We're gonna do some math. So I know we're all very excited about that. Sorry. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a string and we're just going to clamp it at two ends and we're going to apply a force in the middle. And I think those of you who taught physics, right, 2t sine theta should start popping into your head. But we're going to go a little bit beyond that, not too far, right? So we're going to start pulling on the string and we're going to say what's the force as a function of the deflection in the middle. Right, so there's 2t sine theta, right? That's very easy. If you just do your vector components and stuff like that, the force you apply is 2t sine theta. Sine theta is about theta when theta is small. So roughly theta is 2y over L, and so you get force is 2t times y over L. So this actually looks like F equals kx. 4t over L is your spring constant for deflection. And there's your x. That's your deflection. So far, good. But we haven't actually stretched the string yet. So if we start pulling the string too far, it's getting longer. And we haven't taken that into account. Right? So now we have to say, you know what? The tension in the string is not just is whatever initial tension. So we kind of clamp it, and it's pulled taut with some tension. And then as we stretch it out, it's going to get an additional tension, which is just the spring constant times the change in length. So we get an extra term in here that we haven't figured out. Again, this is, instead of spring constant, we'll use Young's modulus times area over length. That's how you get the spring constant, times L. Right? And so now we have to say, well, what is delta L? How much longer has this string gotten as we pull it down? So we do geometry. Some of you may recognize the Pythagorean theorem buried in here, right? We got triangles. And so what we find out is that delta L is just the square root of L squared plus 4y squared minus the original L. And of course, we don't want to have a bunch of square roots, so we simplify, we do an expansion. I hope everybody who teaches math just throws in a couple of these little expansions when they do, in calculus, because none of the students know how to do it, and it's really useful. It's all I know how to do, right? So, anyway, 1 plus epsilon to the x power, 1 plus x times epsilon. Anyway, so here we are. So we can approximate this. We bring out the L. We approximate this square root like so. That's our little expansion, and now we can subtract L, and we basically get delta L to first order is 2y squared over L. There will be a quiz at the end. All right. Okay, so now when we put everything together, we get the tension as a function of y. It's the initial tension in the string plus the extra tension from our deflection, which is proportional to y squared. It's why we can ignore it at the beginning, because y squared is small compared to y. But We put in that extra term, and now what we get is the force looks like this. It has a term that's proportional to y. That's our initial spring stiffness. And now we have a term that's proportional to y cubed. So if you measure force as a function of distance, you'll first see a linear term, and then you'll see a term that goes up like the deflection cubed. So if you pull far enough, that's going to dominate, right? And so you get some basically linear plus cubic terms, right? So you see two different regimes here. And so, you know, I've just made some very toy problem here, right? This is just AY plus BY cubed. At very low deflection, it's linear, it's a nice straight line, and now it looks like a cubic function up here, right? And I should replot this, but maybe some of you are thinking, I bet you if I did a log-log plot, all of these things would be clear. So you could do that also. So, you know, this is often what we see. We don't necessarily measure one thing and see the data, and that all of a sudden the data gives us exactly the answer we need. Often we have to take some data which has a bunch of stuff going on, have a model which takes into account all that stuff and fit the data and the model by seeing, you know, what values of these parameters give us the best fit to our data. This is another thing that, you know, students don't all, you know, it's difficult for students to get, you know, that you don't just get the answer right away from your data. You often have to kind of bring things both from a kind of a modeling point of view and a data point of view and make them meet in the middle to give you the information you need. So let me just give you an example of how we did that, right? So that's what we're going to get. So let me start with an example from carbon nanotubes, right? So a nanotube is a rolled up sheet of graphene. It happened to have been discovered little over 10 years before graphene was discovered, just by the chance of the, who knows. The nice thing is you can grow nanotubes now very, very long. We've actually made them that are, you know, 4 inches long, only a couple nanometers in diameter. That's like a pencil that goes from California to New York, right? So very, very long and thin. And they're so strong and so that you can actually, so this is an electron microscope image of some nanotubes that are actually, this is about 100 micrometers, and these nanotubes are actually just suspended in midair. There's nothing holding them up. So they're a perfect example of that string that we want to do this problem on. So that actually is what we wanted to actually test the stiffness of nanotubes, which was very difficult to do. We wanted to test that by doing some version of this deflection problem. Let me skip that. And so what we ended up doing is an experiment that looked like this. We had these nanotubes that were grown over this kind of long hole, and we could use a laser and bounce a laser off them and see the light scattered off the nanotube. And that would allow us to actually track where the nanotube is. You need a very, very bright laser to do that, but you can do it. So we said, you know, we can actually deflect these nanotubes if we put them in a magnetic field. So we take a little bit of metal on the substrate, we apply a current, we pass a current through the nanotube, and at the same time, so we have a current like this, and we have a magnetic field like this. So what should we all be doing now to figure out what's going to, yeah, everybody should be doing this, right? Or some of us will be doing this, and we'll be, yeah, all right. So, right, so right-hand rules should be happening about now. You should get a Lorentz force, right? So so you get a perpendicular force. So the nanotube is going to be pushed sideways. Right? So now we can put a known force, because we can know what the magnetic field is. We actually use one of these really strong little rare earth magnets you get in a science kit. You know, you can get from some of these little catalogs, you know, they're pretty neat, you know, a little tiny donut. Apply a current through the tube and see how much it's bent, right? So we get one more little toy problem here. In this case, instead of applying a force just at the center of the string, we're applying a uniform force everywhere. And this is actually a neat problem. It turns out to be ultra simple because this force is always perpendicular to the nanotube. Cross products, Lorentz force, all of that right-hand rule is always perpendicular. And that means that this force here never changes the tension, which is always perpendicular to that. And that means the tension is always constant. Right? This is different than if you have a string that's just hanging under its own weight that makes what's called a catenary. That's actually a little bit of a nastier problem. This is the simplest type of this problem you can do. So you have a force like this, it's balanced by two tensions, just like we did before. Same, you know, 2t sine theta. Now in this case, I'm making a little bit of a kind of a differential length of the string, a little tiny nanotubelet here, that is making a circular arc that subtends a little angle d theta. There's a little tiny, little bit of an angle there. And so I say the force is the magnetic field times the current times the length, times the little length from here to here. And that's equal to 2t sine theta over 2. And again, that's just a d theta. And again, I just make sine theta as theta, and out pops this nice thing, right? So the other thing is, so I didn't draw that on here, but this has a radius of curvature. I'll call that rho. And so out of these two equations comes that we can get the radius of curvature is just t divided by magnetic field divided by current. So if you can measure the radius of curvature, you can measure the tension. And if you know the tension is a function of force, all of a sudden you start to have spring constant, Young's modulus. Right? So this is what we were doing. We did it in a slightly, so I'm not going to go into all the different, so all these little pairs of numbers here are telling me what the exact structure of that nanotube is. We have a optical way of measuring that I won't go into, just to suffice it to say that it's hard to do and we're great because we could do it. A slightly different, this equation looks a little bit different, but it's basically the same equation I showed you before. Force, so this now I'm calling delta, just because we love to confuse people. I say you can't just remember the letters. So the delta is this deflection. Force is deflection times, if something that's a little funny, it's the maximum of these two values. This just says if the string is slack, it's going to snap to some deflection really quick. We actually see that right here. It goes slack, you know, it's slack, and so it goes snap, and then starts to deflect, and snap, and then starts to deflect. But ignoring that, we have basically this delta times a delta squared, that's our cubic term, and we have a delta times the initial strain or initial tension, that's our linear term. So we have a linear and a cubic term. We fit these, we just adjust all of our parameters until we get the best fit of the equation to the data. So the things we, you know, basically what we leave is we adjust this until we get the best fit, and that tells us our Young's modulus. So we were able to do this, and the nice thing is by doing it with a few different nanotubes, we were able to measure this Young's modulus, and because we had such good knowledge of the structure, we were actually able to take data that all showed about the same answer, and we compared that to what other people had done, which was kind of all over the map. You know, we said, all right, we've nailed, this is not a giant surprise, it's kind of what we expected, but we've reduced the experimental error bars a lot. But linear plus cubic. So now let me go on to graphene. And again, you know, we were watching all this great graphene stuff go on. You know, we had, one of the leaders in the field was also at Columbia and doing a lot of the great electronics. And we said, we're going to, you know, we try not to step on each other's toes in research too much, especially if they're your colleagues at your own university. But I had a postdoc who was interested in this. He said, well, you know, they're doing all this crazy electronics and quantum Hall effect and stuff. What about mechanics? Let me play around with mechanics. I said, all right, well, you're paid to do biology, but come in at night and do mechanics. And that's what you do, you know? So he said, you know, let's try to measure how stiff and strong graphene is. And let's do it by making a kind of a drum head, right? So what he did was we made a wafer So this is a cartoon of a silicon wafer, and you can process it so it has little holes in it. You kind of drill down with various etching processes, and then we just use the Scotch tape. And the neat thing is, the graphene would just cover the holes. It wouldn't kind of stick down, it would just go right on top. And now, so this is a cartoon of a tip of something called an atomic force microscope. So you heard Eva Andre talking about an STM, a scanning tunneling microscope. This is a cousin of that. This is something that uses force as a way of, as a kind of feedback to find the contours of a surface. All right, so basically, it puts a tip on the edge of a very, very floppy cantilever, and it uses a laser just like this one. I don't have maybe I can use that as a mirror, right? It bounces the laser off the end of the tip, and as the tip starts to bend, as it hits a bump, that laser point will move, and you can find how that laser point moves. That tells you how much you've deflected. And in the real AFM, then what you do is you have a feedback that says, okay, better lift up. So you kind of try to keep the same force all the time by doing kind of a feedback loop. Not details. So these are nice because you can scan over surfaces. You can look at, you saw some images from AFMs. You can find the contours and profile of a surface, but you can also use them for mechanical measurements. So you can push down and pull up and measure force as a function of displacement. This is exactly like our little toy problem, right? So this is something called nano indentation. This is actually done commercially to figure out materials properties. You put a dent in a material and it tells you how these cracks propagate and how hard the material is, things like that. So here's what we made. We can actually see this. So this is a little funny. This is like one of those weird magic eye pictures that you can either see as holes or muffins or something. So this is a flat surface, and these are holes that we've drilled in, and these go down from here. So this surface here is lower than the top surface. Right? So that's, these you're seeing here in an electron microscope are this. Right? And this is the sheet of graphene, and we're seeing the edge. So this is a hole that's completely covered in graphene. This is a hole that's half covered in graphene, and this is empty. So now what we want to do is take this AFM tip and poke the middle of that and try to measure the force versus displacement. Right? And the nice thing is, we didn't do this, but I have a colleague who has one of these tools in an electron microscope. So after the fact, we worked with her group and actually took a movie of this, so you can actually see it happen. So what we're seeing is, again, some of these little membranes. We're seeing them edge on, so instead of circular, they look elliptical. And so that's one membrane. This is 1.5 microns wide. This is another one that's 1 micron wide. And this is this tip coming down. And I need to get a soundtrack to this, like doom, 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 something like that. So this is what we get for excitement here. So here you see now we have the tip starting to hit the graphene sheet. It starts to deflect. It kind of looks like those general relativity diagrams from Stephen Hawking's book, right? And then pokes through, right? But the amazing thing is, it's deflected. This is one atom thick. It's deflected about 100 nanometers for something that's only about a micron in depth. It's deflected a huge amount. All right, so this is quite if you've been working with these kinds of materials, it's really surprising. So, I don't know if I want to talk about this. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about it. So, it turns out in this test, there are two important things that happen. And we actually kind of tried to understand what was going on by something called finite element analysis. This is what engineers use to look at behavior of complicated parts that you can't just write down an equation for. You do a computer simulation of when your axle is going to fail in a car or something like that. And what it told us, so the color shows us the local stress. It shows us the local amount the bonds are bending. And so it tells us that out here at the edge of the sheet, there's not very much stress. which also means there's not very much strain, which means that just this very weak adhesion of the graphene onto the surface is enough to hold it in place. That's really kind of nice. All right, in a nanotube, it would be different. So we tried a lot of these experiments with nanotubes. It never worked the way we wanted it to, because the tension is the same everywhere. It's one-dimensional. You know, you can't have part of a string under tension and then part of it not. The forces don't balance. And so that means every time you try to grab it, you get what's called a stress concentration at the clamp point, and it would always just break where we clamped it. Didn't tell us about the material itself. So here, the place we're clamping it is hardly under any strain at all. That's very nice. The other thing is, right in the center, it's under incredibly high stress. And so that means if we're worried about it breaking, what we really have to do is only pay attention to what's going on right here. By the same token, the exact details of what's going on right under the tip don't really matter for how much the actual membrane is deflecting very much. So this kind of very fortunately, you know, it's one of these things you set up the experiment first and then realize why it worked after it. It separated our problem into two different problems. One is if you measure a force displacement curve, that's going to tell you about the stiffness, and you don't care really what's going on nanoscopically right under that tip. On the other hand, if you want to figure out how strong the material is, you don't really care about the size of the membrane or anything. All you care about is how sharp your tip is. So, here's the kind of data we can get with this AFM. If these are actually now available for, there's a company, is it even in Santa Barbara? No, it's in, no, Long Beach, that you can go build an AFM kit for about $25,000. Still, I know a little bit out of people's budgets, but it's used to be $250, right? So it's getting there. These are not insane to actually think about having in a classroom, or at least, you know, for a school district or something. So, and high school kids can use them, no problem. So what we see when we take this data is, in fact, we see a curve just like I showed in the beginning, and we fit it to a model that has a linear term. This is our initial tension in the membrane. H is the thickness of the membrane, and you say it's 2D, what's the thickness? I'll talk about that. And then a cubic term here, and this cubic term has this Young's modulus in it, right? And lo and behold, it fits extremely well. And again, another way to visualize something that has a polynomial or a power law is to plot it on a log-log scale, and we see at very high deflection, it gets a slope of 3. So it shows that it's going as deflection cubed at high deflection. Right? So this works really well. And we can start extracting data. Right? So what we actually measure, strictly speaking, is something called a second order elastic stiffness. If it's a two-dimensional material, instead of saying force per unit area, we now have to say force per unit length, because what's the thickness? I don't know, right? But when we want to compare to real life, we say, well, look, we can't, if we want to make a bulk material out of graphene, we have to stack the sheets. And when you stack the sheets, you've got graphite. And so what you do is you divide by the thickness of, or the separation between the layers, the sheets in graphite, the interlayer separation, right? So when you do that, you can take this this quantity, which is kind of the strictly speaking the right thing to use, newtons per meter, and get another factor of a meter on the denominator. And so now we have pascals, newtons per square meter, and it's 1 terapascal, which is what is already known pretty well for graphite. Right? And you can measure this pre-stress, which depends on the flake you have, depends on, you know, how hard you pushed with your thumb when you scratch the scotch tape. Okay, so that's nice, but really it's the strength that's the interesting thing here. So then what we did is kept pushing harder and harder, we found the point at which the membranes broke, right? And confirming our finite element model, we saw that, so this is kind of four representative curves. These are the curves that kind of lie on different curves are different diameter membranes, so that changes the force displacement. But on the other hand, the different colors show testing with two different radius tips. And we measure that in an electron microscope. So one is a narrower tip, it's about 17 nanometers, and one is about 28 nanometers. So it doesn't matter what the diameter of the membrane is, the 17 nanometer tip always breaks at a load of 2,000 nanonewtons, 2 micronewtons. Seems small, but for a one atom thick piece of stuff, it's ginormous, to use a technical term. So, and again, if we nearly double the size of the tip, the radius of the tip, we require more force, right? If we're trying to poke through something, the sharper the tip, the easier it is to poke through, and that's all that matters. And in fact, there's a very simple relationship that's predicted for kind of a linear elastic material, the simplest model, that just says this: the force needed to break goes like the square root of the radius of the tip. Right? So if you double the radius of the tip, it takes 1.4 times more force. Okay, so if we just plug into this value, it turns out it gives us the right trend, but it gave us a really, really, really large, unphysically large, much larger than the Griffith prediction strength. And we realized there's one other thing we hadn't thought about. So here's our graphic, and this is schematic, but here, if you can think about a tip like this, the material is under enormous strain right at the bottom of this tip. And at the bottom of this tip, these atomic bonds are stretched an enormous amount. And as you start to stretch those bonds, they become weaker, right? The atoms are farther apart, the quantum mechanical overlap of the orbitals is lower. And so the spring constant, if you just think of springs between these atoms, you've got a weaker spring, right? It's not nice old Hooke's law anymore. The spring constant changes. And that means the material is no longer linear elastic. It's not F equals KX. It has an extra term that softens as you pull it farther. And so we had to think, how do we put that in there? So we did the simplest possible thing. We replaced Hooke's law. We just put in one extra term. So we said, okay, there's some linear term. We know what that is. We've measured that. Let's put in a quadratic term. Why not? And then we had to kind of play with our finite element analysis. We had to do a bunch of stuff, but we basically tried a bunch of the different values of this parameter D until we got the one that fit our data best. And so we can get that, and that tells us what the place where this turns over gives you the ultimate strength of the material. After that, the material becomes weaker as you stretch it more, and it'll break. So if you apply this amount of stress right here, it's unstable and it breaks. Right? So this gave us an ultimate strength about 130 gigapascals, and this is, as you heard this morning, it made this the strongest material ever made. That was kind of a fun thing here. Strongest material ever measured. It was a fun motivation for the folks who were doing the work. I said, guys, in 10,000 years, you will still have the record. Right? I've said it's the strongest material in the universe, but I think, unless you get into cores of neutron stars and things like that. So, strongest material hanging around on Earth anyway. So that's interesting. So let's just put this in perspective a little more, right? So this is from a common engineering materials book. But if you want to look for materials with different properties, you flip through this and find the kinds of materials you want. And this is a chart of yield strength. That's exactly what we've been measuring as a function of density, right? So you have cork and balsa wood down here. They're very light, not super, super strong. You have things like tungsten alloys that are very, very dense but very strong. Steel, composite materials, carbon fibers and stuff are here. And the company did this for us. The graphene's up here, literally off the chart. Right? So this is a log scale. So that's two orders of magnitude. Right? So again, it shows us these are the materials of our everyday world, and you get down to nano, and you get this. Right? As another way of explaining this, actually, this was just picked up by Scientific American a couple months ago. We tried to, give one of the, you do the press release for your paper and try to get some, try to explain it to the civilians out there. And so we came up with this example, which has then somehow made its way around the internet in various nerdy circles. So, the quote was like this: it would take an elephant balanced on a pencil to break through a sheet of graphene the thickness of saran wrap, right? And that was just basically going through and saying, okay, if I take the ultimate strength and I scale the thickness here and the radius of curvature, what is the force I get? Right? So that's what, we sat down with a back of the envelope and calculated that, and it was roughly a few thousand pounds, so it, elephant sounded good. And it went all over the place, and they finally, tracked it back down to us, yada, 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 yada. So 200 times stronger than steel, elephant balanced on a pencil to break through a sheet of graphene, the thickness of saran wrap. And so they made a nice graphic for us, which was really fun. I thought, I wish we had an art department that could do that. So this also raised some very important questions. What is the pencil made of? They said, well, you'd have to make the pencil out of graphene also. And actually, it's an interesting thing because in our experiments, we first started using AFM tips made out of silicon. This is, they normally make it out of etched silicon. We said, we're only trying to break through one atom, for goodness sake, that should be fine. It turns out one atom of graphene was enough to break these silicon crystal tips. And it that set us back about 9 months trying to figure out what was going on. We finally had to use diamond. A couple thousand dollars later to get your custom diamond tip, and we were in business. So they were on to something with that first question. Then, how do you get the elephant onto the pencil? Is it an African elephant or an Asian elephant? This is kind of getting into Monty Python territory here. maybe a baby Asian elephant, which I think is more accurate anyway. Do you play baby elephant walk? Anyway, so that's been fun. So then that's the end of that. Five more minutes, all right. Let me tell you about, I just put this in just after lunch, speaking of fast preparation, because there was a comment about friction during our discussion. So we actually, and it's actually interesting for another reason, another study we did that has, is related to the mechanics of graphene was to actually take that same atomic force microscope. Instead of pressing down, we dragged it sideways and measured, you can kind of see how it tilts, and that measures the frictional force. And it turns out I had a postdoc who was doing this, but we had a very bright high school student who came to work in the lab. And my postdoc said, he learned to use the AFM and, came in every day after school. And postdoc said, start measuring friction and tell me what you see. And he said, it's really funny. He made samples that looked like this. So this is some of this scratch graphene. You can kind of see different colors here, different shades. And these are actually different numbers of atomic layers. So when you go in, you look in the AFM, you make a color scale that shows you the topography. And you can see areas where you get different layers all lining up. And so here we have one layer, two layers, three layers, and four layers. So it goes from dark to bright. And Will, the high school student, said, it's a little funny. Maybe our software is messed up or something. But every time I plot the friction, the color scale is reversed. Right? The common sense, right? He did fine on tests too. He's at MIT now. So, he saw the friction signal being highest for one layer and lowest for the thicker samples. So the color scales are reversed. So we banged our heads around this for a while. Why is friction is a property of surfaces? How does the surface know what's underneath? Homework problem, right? We work with a friend of mine who's at UPenn who studies this stuff for a living, and he's got this beautiful AFM that can actually do this on a smaller scale, and you can actually see the tip going bumpity 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 bump over single atoms. So you can actually image the atomic lattice this way. That's kind of neat. So you can see these are the bumpity bumps for different layers. So what we decided to do just for fun is instead of just saying, you know, what's going on with graphene, let's just say, is this something that is some weird property of graphene, Dirac fermions, I don't know what? Or is it just because it's a thin material? So we learned as you know, led by the Geim group, who has demonstrated a lot of this already, we learned to do the same scotch tape trick on other materials. And you can get other materials. One is a semiconductor, this is a metal, and this is an insulator. They're very, very different properties, different lattices, different everything, and we saw the same trend all the time. Thicker they got, the lower the friction. And so, again, after banging our heads against the wall for quite a while, we realized, and you know, doing a lot of kind of control type experiments, we realized that what was happening when you drag the tip across this material, it's actually not stuck very well to the substrate. And so it's free to deform a little bit. Right? And so what happens is when you have a very thin membrane, it's very stiff this way, but it's very floppy out of plane. And so it's actually free to kind of conform to the tip. And it's like rolling a furniture across a rug, right? You always get it at the leg of the furniture, you always get a little divot, and that kind of makes it a lot harder to roll, right? And the stiffer the rug, the less that effect is, right? So in a very floppy material, you know, which is one layer, it deforms a lot as you go in different directions. And as you just make these materials thicker, they get stiffer to bending, and that reduces the friction. So kind of neat. Let me just talk for 10 seconds or whatever about where we think this is going in the kind of the mechanical world. And, you know, we talked a little bit about over lunch. I think that an enormous area we're going to see graphene in very soon is in composite materials. In this case, again, you know, thinking about why do things break because of cracks. And where you're going to use graphene is not to make a material stronger on a large scale, it's to stop cracks. So when you try to break a material, the crack goes through the, you know, through whatever it is. If you put a wall there, the crack has to go around the wall, and that's a lot harder. Right? So this has been done for many, many years, putting different nano fillers. They put nano clay, mica. These are things that are already put into composites, but graphene you can make thinner, it's stronger, you can do crazy chemical bonding. And this is just one paper where they show this is DADN is how fast this crack moves. And if you take the pristine epoxy and if you put graphene in it, it changes the rate of crack propagation by 2 or 3 orders of magnitude. Right? So that means things are going to not fatigue nearly as fast. Right? That's important. We've already seen this, so I won't go through this, but it's so strong that you can make a freestanding membrane. One of the nice applications there is that you can use this to support, it's only one atom thick, you can use this to support other things that are interesting to look at. So for instance, you can put a protein or a virus down on it and put it in an electron microscope, and the graphene will have very, very small impact on the image. And so you can really much more easily study things like that in an electron microscope. So, in fact, you can even get so sensitive that it's been claimed, I think there's still some disagreement here, that you can actually see a single hydrogen atom in an electron microscope. You know, smallest, lightest atom, this is the limit of what, you know, this should be the hardest thing to see in an electron microscope. There's The other thing, as we heard before, is this is a perfect membrane, but if you punch a little hole through it, if you can control the size of the hole, you can make a filter for different sizes of molecules. So that's another thing that's really interesting. You can actually make bubbles. So we had a paper where we looked at bubbles trapped under graphene. This is another group kind of has made kind of graphene balloons where you can really have, if you have gas pressure, you can make it either push a membrane out or in, and you can do all kinds of interesting things with that. We heard about DNA sequencing through nanopores as you make a little hole in this graphene membrane, which is conducting and all sorts of good things, then you can put you can try to get DNA to go through it, and you can try to look at an electrical property of the DNA as it passes through and go chink 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 and get the sequence in real time. That's the idea. My group specifically is trying to take these little membranes and vibrate them at very high speed. So this is kind of like, they're not guitar strings, I guess they're more like drum heads. Little nano drum heads. So there it is. That's our little nano drum head, and we read it out electrically. The idea is that as the graphene vibrates up and down, we have charge on this gate. As you go closer to the gate, you draw more charge onto the graphene. That changes its conductivity, and so that it will change the current going from source to drain. So it's a transistor, but the vibration of the graphene modulates the current. You get more or less, more or less, more or less. That gives you an AC current coming out the end, and there's some funny, interesting things you can do with that. You get a peak in the current at the resonant frequency of the graphene. So I think that's the last. So where we're, all trying to hopefully go with this, you can see this is an outdated slide by the type of cell phone in there, but it turns out that things like little oscillators and resonators and stuff like that are actually very fundamental parts of high-speed signal processing that digital chips don't do very well. So there's an active effort by a lot of people to try to use little mechanically vibrating widgets to do some of the stuff that happens in a cell phone that you can't do with a digital chip. So I'm over time, so I think I'll end here. Thank you all for your attention.
Okay, so the floor is open for questions and comments.
I have a question. Could you tell us something, sort of speculate on the future for nanotubes for elevators to outer space and things like that?
The future of the nanotube space elevator is just as right as it ever was, which is not at all. I mean, I don't know. It's a great motivating principle. Say, look, let's try to take this material and push it as far as we possibly can. We're not going to make space elevators with it, but we've gone from growing just little tiny bits of nanotubes to, I actually have this in another presentation, which I was stealing slides from. I think I have it here. So in the last couple years, people have figured out how to make kind of forests of the nanotubes. So this is, a millimeter high. That's a match head right there. So that's a lot of nanotubes for people like me who are usually just used to growing a couple. And then you get this, right? So there are companies that are really doing very large. So this is, that same forest, now the size of a real person. So, and they can spin this into cables. So they have cables now that are a few kilometers long. There's not one nanotube going from beginning to end. So this cable is not a lot. I think it's about as strong as steel or Kevlar. I don't remember the exact. But, it has lots of other good properties. It's a lot lighter, for instance. And so in that way, it's already moving, using composite materials, things like that.
Yeah, thank you. From the engineering economics point of view, if you compare graphene against the superconductors, which one would be the winner? strict engineering economics.
Like which one is going to make more money in the end, or
which one is more
which one can we
feasible,
get more grant money for?
No, which one is more feasible economically, easier to produce, and more practical?
Well, yes, superconductors. I mean, they're going into production now for power transmission. It's going to be a little bit of a niche market, and then of course MRI machines and stuff like that. You know, this one of the things, one of the reasons I think you're going to see graphene in real composite materials applications is because you can make it by taking a bunch of graphite, which you dig out of the ground, and chemically treating it, mixing it in with polymer at very, very low fractions, you know, a 1% or less, and have really big increases in performance. So it's cost-wise, it's going to be very different. It's really much more of a low-tech thing that, you know, there's already technologies that are out there. Whether any of us will make money on it, you know, that's another matter. But
I come from a background with defects in primarily in metals, and all these slides that I see, the graphene is so perfect. I don't see any structure defects at all.
Right.
But, there was one slide earlier speaker had of impurity sitting on there and some topological changes. Are the impurity substitutional, or is that just sitting there? Or the other is, why isn't, like for instance, vacancy and dislocation and interstitials?
Right, so you know, we've all talked about graphene is perfect. And why, what are the, nothing in nature is completely perfect, and what are the nature of the imperfections, right? There are many. I think one of the reasons we, you know, when we do the Scotch tape method, for instance, we always find perfect graphene is because it's naturally going to break where you have defects, you have grain boundaries, things like that. And so when we extract it, we're selecting for places that are already strong and don't have any defects. We've been growing graphene by chemical vapor deposition, where you can get very large sheets. This is how you get the Samsung 30-inch pieces. In that case, you get lots of grain boundaries, and actually we and other groups have been doing the same nanoindentation tests, and they're a lot weaker. They break along those grain boundaries. That's just where the, you know, the graphene has come together at some weird angle, and all the bonds aren't exactly right. So you can have all sorts of funny things. You can have the, instead of two rings of six, if you rotate one of the bonds, you get one ring of five and one ring at seven. That's the, kind of the most common type of defect, and then you can arrange those to get all kinds of things. You can certainly have vacancies and things like that also, but I don't think we all know extremely well what's going on. Certainly, Eva, you can say, right, in STM, you just never find, like, single point defects, right? Yeah.
Well, the reason I asked was I read it not long ago. Somebody is trying to make the structural defects of triangular shape, so probably arrangement of vacancies.
Yeah.
And that promised to be graphene to become piezoelectric. And but circular or don't, I mean, vacancy in circular or other geometry don't work, but only triangular is there. And the way they did was with electron gun, I believe. So radiation damage.
I think certainly that in general, we were talking about nano ribbons over lunch also. Carving graphene into strips or other shapes, triangular holes or things like that, with atomic precision is certainly one of the kind of grand challenges of the field. Because it really matters whether you have an atomically perfect edge versus one that just has kind of a nanometer of roughness. All properties change dramatically. So we're not there yet. But.
I'm Cliff Parker from Edwardsville, Illinois. You've mentioned a couple times, and other speakers have too, about growing graphene. Can you shed any light on how that is done? I can't imagine using giant rolls of Scotch tape forever.
The 3M would like that, but Sorry, I'm just going through. This is another. Ah, here we go. All right, so here's a picture of one of these ovens that's used to grow graphene by something called chemical vapor deposition. It's actually pretty straightforward. You take copper foil, just like aluminum foil, copper. You clean it very well. You put it in an oven inside a quartz tube that heated up to about 1,000 degrees Celsius in an atmosphere of argon and hydrogen, so you have no oxygen around. And then you flow in a little bit of methane. Methane decomposes. It cracks on the surface catalytically on the surface of the copper. So you get little carbon atoms rolling around. They come together and they form a single layer of graphene. So you can get basically this copper foil is coated top and bottom with one sheet of graphene. And then you have to figure out how to peel that off of the copper. And that's really the way it's done now is you actually etch away the copper. You put it in a bath of copper etching, get rid of it. And it works great, but it's expensive. You're wasting a big sheet of copper for every sheet of graphene you're making. So you know, people are trying to figure out ways to do it cheaper.
Okay, so I guess it's about time for us to go out for our break. So we'll reconvene at 3:30. Let's thank our speaker again.
I knew her laminate.